Welcome to Network Capital, Eleanor. I really enjoyed attending your classes, went through your work, and I thought it would be interesting to host you to discuss important constructs about the internet and how it's shaping our society. So welcome to Network Capital. I would love to learn a bit more about your career. How did you get interested in these questions and an overall trajectory that you've taken so far?
Well, thanks so much for having me on. It's a pleasure. My career so far has been a series of happy accidents. And it's something that I'm really keen to share with people because I remember at school and at university having a really clear sense that I wanted to be a lawyer. And as you can tell, I'm not. And so the beginning of my career was a real muddle. I left law school before I even started, the day before I got on a flight to Australia. And when I got back, I remember thinking, I have no idea what I wanted to do at all. And actually, a couple of weeks ago, I found myself speaking to young people at BNP Paribas, right, at a talk titled, How to Ace the Start of Your Career. And I totally did not ace the start of my career, and yet there I was. And it's a scary world out there for young people who are expected to really know what they're doing and get it right in the first 5 years. And I would just urge everyone to forget about that, throw that out the window, because you can get to things quite late. And just through finding out what you like and don't like and playing it by ear. So I think I would have saved many tears if someone had told me that when I was 24. But the first thing I did when I got back from Australia was to work in tech at some really small, really terrible incubators where there's a bunch of different startups trying to work out what they want to do. And you're doing anything for any company that will take you, whether it's, you know, small bits of digital marketing or liaising with product to try and help them. And it was terrifying and confusing, but gave me quite a nice insight into what it actually takes to build something from scratch. And so my next job was at Wise, previously TransferWise, doing peer money transfers. And we were only about 200 at the time. But I then started a company with some AI engineers who worked there who were Spanish. And we imported jamón ibérico, Spanish ham, and sold it online. And that gave me a kind of insight into e-commerce, and also the chaos of trying to store loads and loads of ham in a fridge that was going to go off. So never again will I ever work with perishable items.
Yes.
But yeah, I found myself doing a PhD in science fiction and philosophy because I thought it would be fun and interesting. And then from there, really enjoyed it. So kind of stuck around and did my first postdoc at Cambridge, working with a big tech company, interviewing people about AI engineering. So again, really nothing in common from one thing to another, but just pursued my interests as and when they came along.
But it's a spectacular career. And one of the reasons we started Network Capital, because young people around the world have this invisible pressure to know exactly what they want to do early on. And it's only through a series of experiences, experiments, that you can potentially get to that answer. So congratulations on building a really interesting career. Talk to us about your journey into academia. So you, after being an entrepreneur, perhaps working in a large company like TransferWise, so you had this entrepreneurial streak and you took it to academia. What was that like?
Entrepreneurship has a lot in common with academia because certainly as a researcher, you have to go and find areas that interest you, read into them, and then write about them and write books, create collaborations. And really, there's no one telling you exactly how you should do this. There's no one really looking over your shoulder. And I really like that about academia. I'm a bit of a lone wolf and I love to collaborate, but on my own terms. And now that I manage teams at Cambridge, it's sort of like that. You're never really a manager in academia. You have to sort of encourage people with incentives to do what you need them to do. And so I find myself a bit of a salesman as well, because people aren't expected to do what they're told to do in their 9 to 5. You have to kind of win people over, even the researchers in your own team. So there's a lot in common, I think. I love the freedom to roam. I love that I can go to a doctor's appointment in the middle of the day and not have to tell anyone. People know that, you know, as a researcher, it's your whole life. You love it. You work not just 9 to 5, but you know, you'll have a 14-hour day and then the next day no inspiration and do, you know, very little. But it's very much up to you, and you have to be the kind of person that self-motivates in order to do it. So yeah, lots in common with entrepreneurship.
So as I understand, you're a researcher, podcaster, now an author. What does a day in your life look like?
A very different day to day. This morning, I spent quite a few hours looking at the proposal I'm writing for a new trade book, which is called AI, a User's Manual. And I'm reading through the edits that are suggested by my agent. I have three agents. One is for this book, which is a trade book, which basically means just popular science, something that my mum can read. And then I have two other agents for speaking gigs. So I spend a lot of time doing speaking outside of my work at Cambridge. And this basically funds my life. Cambridge is lovely, but doesn't pay very well. And I realized that actually there is lots you can do in academia to earn extra money. I think in, you know, in STEM, if you're an engineer or something and you do 2 years of a research project at Cambridge, you can then do 2 years at Microsoft and kind of swing back and forth. And this is really helpful for people who have that kind of expertise. In the humanities, you're expected to be, you know, poor for life. And so finding different ways out has been really useful. And there are plenty, you know, you can do consultancy. I was joking with a friend of mine who's a medievalist at Oxford, who was like, you know, I'm not doing AI ethics. I'm looking at medieval triptychs. How am I supposed to earn a proper living? And now on TV, there are TV shows about pilgrimages and medieval England. And I thought, well, you could do that. You know, you could start your own TikTok about medieval pilgrimages across the UK. You know, people are always looking to academics to provide them something interesting. TikTok is really pushing educational content. And from there, you can gain traction and maybe do your own TV show or something. So there's lots of different ways you can, again, with the entrepreneurial spirit, try and make it work. So my day is sort of divided into these different books that I'm writing, publicity. I have my own podcast, The Good Robots, where we interview leading thinkers in technology, whether they be activists who start big tech unions or youth activists or artists. Today I had a couple of artists contact me who wanted to make one of my previous projects on hiring AI into a piece of art. So I created, with some computer scientists at Cambridge, an online tool that helps you understand how video hiring tools work or how they don't work. And it's called Personality Machine. And I did this quite a while ago, but people come back and they get in touch with you wanting to do stuff with these kinds of tools that you develop. So we're doing a lot at Cambridge in our center with AI and art, working with artists to help improve AI literacy using art. And we love working with these artists. And so it's really nice people get in touch with you and try and spin off our projects about AI for different audiences. I spent a couple of hours today planning a workshop with some community centres in London to try and help young people know how they can get into a career with AI, but not just young people who are wealthy or from schools that can afford to have us give a talk, but from one of them is a community centre near Grenfell Tower that burned down. And I was working with them for a bit after I did my PhD, helping kids with homework and helping improve literacy in the area. And I think it's really important to go and give talks to people who might not otherwise get this kind of information about AI. I feel really icky often when I'm, you know, spend all my time paid to give talks to people who already have access to really good information. And I really want to spend more time giving information from Cambridge, you know, straight from these kind of, you know, high-end institutions to people who will be interacting a lot with AI. Whether they be through, you know, getting credit loans, AI at the supermarket, AI, you know, when they're accessing their benefits, and yet really don't have much confidence in knowing what these systems do and how they affect them. And then, you know, I'm creating the world's first tool that will help companies meet the EU AI Act obligations. So this big bit of AI regulation. And we're sending the first version of this tool out to our stakeholders, our advisory board today. So I've been liaising with the team, checking that through. And then I had a supervision with a student and been doing some marking. And I help students at Gonville and Caius College with pastoral care. So just to make sure they're okay, you know, with students who have mental health issues or need some form signing, so they don't have to pay for their accommodation during holidays. Yeah, so a huge range of stuff.
But a really busy life. You know, I used to work at Microsoft and then I started Network Capital. And now I'm, you know, about to start my DPhil. So a lot of your insights would be really helpful. A book that I wrote before, Passion Economy and the Side Hustle Revolution, essentially makes the case that no matter which industry you're in, if you're entrepreneurial about your career, you can create different income streams on your terms. And it seems to me that you've done a really good job of that. Do you want to tell us a bit about your relationship with TikTok?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was working with a data rights organization called The Citizens, and they were founded by Carol Cadwalader, who helped break the Cambridge Analytica scandal by connecting with a whistleblower at Cambridge Analytica, who was really, you know, felt really ill at ease with what they were doing. And now The Citizens, this fantastic organization of investigative journalists, partner with academics who look into specific technologies that they think are being used to do something unpleasant, usually in relation to the government or the police. And for quite a few years, I've been tracking a company called Dataminer, which was initially used in the States to help journalists break news stories, and then was used by the LAPD and the Baltimore Police Force to help track, monitor, and shut down Black Lives Matter protests. And me and my colleague Federica Frabetti at Roehampton discovered that these tools were being used by the UK government, who'd spent as much as £5 million on them. And we were pretty sure that the police were using them, the Met Police in the UK. And with Max Colbert, a fantastic journalist at The Citizens, he helped with Liberty Human Rights Watch find a whistleblower at the Met Police who told us, yes, Dataminer is being used to track and monitor protests in the UK. And I started TikToking about this because The Citizens have a TikTok channel and it's a great way of reaching lots of people. In fact, it's kind of astonishing. You know, the first time I realized that 20,000, 40,000 people had seeing one of my TikToks, it's a really odd feeling. And it's kind of embarrassing as a researcher, you know, you're supposed to be this extremely, the true adult role is to be a professor at Cambridge. And I guess I've never really looked the part anyway. But it's been fun to discover another way of doing academia where it doesn't have to be quite so serious. And doesn't have to be so privileged either. You know, can reach a lot of people in different language. You can cover yourself in a robot filter. There is no embarrassment really when it comes to doing this public facing work, because you just do what you got to do to help sell a message, to tell a story that's being that people are gatekeeping from you.
We hosted this journalist who wrote a book about TikTok and how it works. And he recently covered one of your papers on hiring. Chris, do you want to tell us about a nerdy academic paper, how it went viral? And how are you able to straddle and be sane managing the serious academic world, the TikTok world, and the online fame? And we would then come into more controversial topics, or somewhat controversial topics.
Well, that's very kind of you and of him. It's the hiring paper that he was talking about.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't necessarily think I've struck the right balance between any of these things. It's very slapdash. I kind of put stuff out there and see how it goes. The reason why, when we wrote this paper on technologies used for recruitment, and they're the technologies I was just talking about, so hiring tools that claim to be able to read your personality from looking at your face. And I found these technologies really odd because I'm not sure what my personality is half the time. I'm sometimes quite extrovert. Sometimes I feel, oh God, like I really need some time out. And I'll find myself at you know, parties in the bathroom, just sitting and taking some time for myself. So when these tools claim to be able to do that on our behalf, I thought that this was worth looking into. So they use the Big Five psychological assessment to read your gestures and your keywords. So the Big Five is neuroticism, extroversion, introversion, those kinds of traits. And they map them out against how you move and how you speak. And we, Kerry McNerney and I, critique these tools on the basis that you cannot read someone's personality through AI, for a start. Secondly, doing that doesn't diversify the workforce, because diversity is more than just stripping people down to neutral data points. This is the kind of key thing that we were trying to question, is why do we want to be colorblind or blind to gender? Closing our eyes and pretending that we don't see is not the solution. In fact, all it does is just turn our back against the problem and try and outsource it to technology. And I worked with these amazing computer science students who were really upset by this claim, because they wanted to be seen generously by recruiters. They want to be loved and understood for who they are, and represented by the people who are doing the recruiting. So this was what we were talking about in our paper. And what was really nice is that loads of recruitment people read it. And it wasn't just going into the academic community. It was being read by hiring managers and recruiters who had been, you know, potentially pitched these tools by vendors, but were sort of unsure about it. And this contact with the outside world, with people who are domain experts, was really reassuring, and just created a really great connection, I think, between academia and people with domain expertise.
Thank you for doing this. I think whether somebody agrees with you or not, it's an important discussion to have, which brings me to the main reason why we're here, to discuss your book and some of the concepts that you advance that are close to you. Tell us about your latest book and how it connects to the podcast. Why did you write it?
Yeah, so The Good Robot book, which is out with Bloomsbury, is my baby. I spent a long time doing it. When I told my mom that, I rang her to say, you know, we've sold 300 books in 3 weeks. I think she thought I was going to tell her that I was pregnant. She was really disappointed when that turned out not to be the case. It's based on the podcast, which was us interviewing the people that we're obsessed with. You know, Kerry and I are huge fans of a lot of different people who work in tech, science fiction writers, very, very famous philosophers. And I always put that in inverted commas because, you know, they're people, they're the Nietzsches of today that we may not have heard of. I think if many of us were alive in the era of Plato and Aristotle, we wouldn't have heard of them either. But I am telling you, you know, you've got to read these guys. These are the big voices of the present and the future. So we wanted them to respond to the question, what is good technology, in 2,000 words. So they have, you know, responses like good technology is free, or good technology is symbiotic with nature. And they explore these in a really simple, accessible way. And I have edited these essays within an inch of their life to make them readable. So this is, I think, some of the easiest stuff to read of some of the hardest, deepest thinkers around. And that's why I love this book. And we've divided it into different sections based on different themes. And in each section, we explain why we love these thinkers. Because I think a lot of the time, feminism is about the relationships that we have with the people that we read and that we admire. It's not good enough for somebody to be an amazing philosopher, but be like a real dick in their lives. You know, we want people who are really nice, good people that we love. And so we explain how we got to know them and what that relationship is about. So there's a friendliness in the book. There's a sort of solidarity that is there between all the thinkers, because people reference each other and they talk about how they know us as well. So there's a really nice atmosphere within the book as well that I hope people enjoy.
So a kinder book for a kinder internet. That's what it seems like. So,
but not a simple one. I think this is really important as well, is that within the book, there's people who disagree with each other, and there is room for dissent and different approaches. So it's not a simple feminism. It's one that's steeped in contradictions, in complicity with big tech. It's not like, oh, everyone is so righteous and, you know, goody two shoes. No, everybody, you know, has their own struggles, being involved in ideas that they sometimes agree with, sometimes don't. So yeah, there's complexity there as well, which is important to us.
Absolutely. So what is feminism and how does it matter, or how does it shape technology? Because many of our listeners are not in tech. Many are not. So we want them to understand the various angles of this discussion.
Yeah, I think that's totally fine not to be involved and not to know about feminism per se or be writing about it explicitly. And that's why in the book, we also have Buddhist philosophers who we explicitly ask this question, you know, what is feminism and how does it live in your work? And some of whom, you know, have never really considered that to be the focus of their work. But Kerry and I come in and we're like, yeah, we think this is feminist. So we take a very inclusive perspective on what feminism is, which is important to us. I think it's interesting to complicate what the boundaries of feminism are. A lot of people don't want to politicize themselves or haven't found the right moment to, or don't know how to, and that's okay. So we define feminism as feminisms, plural. We obviously are trans inclusive, and we don't believe that transphobia or transphobic feminisms are feminist at all, really. So there we do have a limit, but at the same time, we open up feminism to different generations. My mother's version of feminism is not the same as mine. In fact, I think my father is a more kind of radical contemporary feminist than my mom is in some ways, just because of the way that she was treated and how she was taught to behave as a woman. So I think those kind of conflicts between generations are really important as well, of me explaining to my mom why wearing a short skirt shouldn't invite sexism or praying eyes, and her explaining to me, well, actually, this kind of feminism where we count how many women are in the business is really important. Whereas to me, feminism might be a bit more kind of genderqueer or a bit less obvious, if that makes sense. So it's about conversations between ages. I think the oldest person in the book, the oldest contributor is 77. The youngest was 16. And you can sense those generational differences too.
Now, thank you for laying it out. There's been a lot of discussion about the trans inclusion, or debates about the trans movement. Are you comfortable talking about what should be the right way, or what could be one right way of trans inclusion, and just thinking about trans people?
Yeah, absolutely. For me, the focus of my life has always been, how can we love people better? And I think it's an easy way of trying to find the right path is saying, is this loving? Are my actions contributing to people being at risk of harm? Or are they helping avoid that? And I think that, you know, you can really navigate the world much more easily if you do that. There's a few people at Cambridge, particularly in my college, who are transphobic. And a lot of their ideas, I think, are grounded in the idea that, you know, there's a right way of understanding biology, or there's a right way of acting on religious dogma, for example. But I think if you move towards the idea of, are we loving people in the right way? Is it important to voice our complaints, or is it important to treat people as they want to be treated? And it's such a simple thing to do, to treat people as they want to be treated, to love them as we would want to be loved ourselves. And that's it. There doesn't have to be any sort of intellectual rationale behind it. This is about living with each other. We are not on Earth as separate beings. We are on earth to share the earth with people that we might not want to share it with. And you know, you can look to Hannah Arendt, the great Jewish post-war philosopher, on sharing the world and what that means, or you can just understand it in your heart. My dad, you know, is 72 or 73. He's never been taught philosophy, but he's never questioned that we should listen to people and treat them how they're telling us they want to be treated, as long as that doesn't cause harm. And I think that both approaches are great, whether we want to overthink it or underthink it. We just need to love each other better.
You know, and the reason of asking you this question is not necessarily about the sport, the realm of sports in which it's discussed, or bathrooms, but with regards to artificial intelligence. One of the ways in which classification works is it's a shortcut, basically. Like, a person who, say, look, has certain features is gender A, and a person who perhaps matches another type is gender B. And your approach is to be a bit more holistic, and be perhaps more loving. And you work with, you know, technologists, you've been an entrepreneur yourself. How do you see this panning out, perhaps trans inclusion or any kind of inclusion, when you look to broaden the parameters? What might that entail?
It's a great question, and it's a tricky one to resolve. We can either do it in terms of inclusion within categories, but that doesn't really solve the issue. Because if you take dating apps, for example, Kevin Guyon has an amazing book called Queer Data, and his next book is coming out and looking at trans inclusion and non-binary inclusion in online dating, and whether just creating more categories basically solves the problem or not. And the problem of anomalies, of minorities, and trying to redo classification in order to cater for different groups of people, or different self-defined groups of people. But I think that we need to look beyond categorization, which can be a bit of a muddle and often a short-term fix, and look at the reason why different things are categorized, look at equality more broadly, look at the way that different apps or different AI systems surveil people differently, and see this as a question of power rather than as a kind of short-term issue of just putting people in boxes, if that makes sense. Go on.
This is a very helpful start, because many people who listen to this are also in tech, people like you who have been there. What should their main takeaway be after reading your book?
Oof, what a question. Well, I wouldn't want to dictate people's takeaways, but I hope that they find the question of AI more approachable. I'd like to see AI as a collection of stories rather than a tool per se, because often we're told the story of AI from above. We're told it in a kind of hype-filled way by tech companies or by the media. And actually, it should be a collection of stories from below, from the people who do the data annotation work that are paid $15 an hour in Seattle, or are working in a sweatshop in China. There was a spate of suicides, you know, in 2011 in an iPad workshop. These are the stories that are undertold, but they're part of what AI is. It's the people that are making it, not just the engineers on six-figure salaries that we think of when we think of a tech worker, but everybody else. It's us giving the traces of our lives to technology through data. It's silicon monocrystals, these very beautiful artifacts that go into making AI what it is. It's the geopolitics around lithium, around Taiwan. It's water, lithium, incredibly water intensive. All these component features of AI, petty bureaucrats in Brussels taking money and free lunches from Microsoft's lobbyists. All these things make AI what it is and give us places where we can intervene.
May I ask you a bit about the critical race theory and what being an anti-racist in the AI age means?
Yeah, absolutely. So my background is in queer studies and anti-racism. And one of the ways that this plays out, for example, is if you think of the hiring example I gave before, where these tools claim not to see race and gender, there's lots of critical race theory on why well-meaning liberals, particularly in the West, would prefer not to see color. This idea of the colorblind ideal, where people think of humans as all the same underneath it all, that the idea that we are just human, which is a humanist ideal that did a lot of good work in the abolitionist movement, where you had abolitionists saying, you know, we are all human, and that was an important moment in order to justify the removal of slavery. But now in this moment, those kinds of humanist arguments are levied by usually white people in the West to try and avoid the issue of racism. And they don't work. They don't really address the problem. So I look at what race is and how it's created through technology rather than being something that needs to be categorized, if that makes sense. So race is often the product of racism, as Paul Gilroy, this wonderful critical race theorist, the grumpiest of academics, but also a brilliant one, who wrote a book called Black Atlantic and Against Race. And that helps us really understand what race is, because I think that, you know, lots of tech people can uncritically try and deal with race in their AI systems as something that just needs to be categorized. But actually, race is something that is socially produced through AI systems as well. We need to be really attentive to the way that AI, that race emerges through economic or socioeconomic and health inequalities, rather than being something that is just skin deep.
Fair enough. What do you think people misunderstand most about the critical race theory being anti-racist and you know, the way they build technology systems?
How do you want me to answer that in a different way than...
Perhaps through an example would be really helpful. Maybe let's take the case of hiring or health system, a kind of bias that you've seen often creep up.
Yeah. Well, the example of race being something that's understood to be skin deep was written about by Franz Fanon, fantastic thinker that originally wrote in French and talks about how race is often seen as something that is literally epidermalized, that is just something that's in the skin rather than something that's socially produced through inequalities. That's the first thing. This plays out in lots of different kinds of approaches to debiasing AI. So there was a project called Gender Shades, done a few years back by Tamit Gebru, this fantastic computer scientist who was fired by Google for her paper on why large language models could be too big, and why that was dangerous, and Joy Bwalamwini. And together they created a project called Gender Shades that was designed to increase diversity in AI data sets. So they wanted more women and more people of color, specifically more women of color, in these data sets so that facial recognition could be better at identifying the faces of Black women. And this was important, not least because that, you know, a few years later, the Her Majesty's Passport Office in the UK created this new tool that helped you take a passport photo of yourself as a selfie and upload it, so that when you renewed your passport, you didn't have to bother going and getting a passport photo taken of you and someone to sign it on the back and et cetera. So this was a great, really useful tool, but it was telling Black women that their mouths were open when in fact they were closed, because there weren't many Black women in the data sets on which it was trained. And so you had these very racist outcomes being kind of indicative of what it meant to be a citizen or a non-citizen in the UK. So that was really important because these errors weren't just there to make the system inaccessible to Black women, but also to make them feel bad about themselves in the relation to the country within which they live. So you can see why these projects to increase representation in data sets mattered. However, we also know that facial recognition disproportionately harms women of color. They're more likely to be targeted for surveillance. And there's loads that's been written about this, loads of examples, particularly in the States. And so you then have this really interesting question of what does it actually mean to de-bias a system? Because is inclusion the way forward? Or should we just be saying no? Should we be opting out? And actually, I think that both of these attempts to change what's going on, which can both be called feminist, although you can see how they really are at odds with each other. They take these very different approaches because they have different timelines, short-term versus long-term inclusion.
A lot of tech people will say, oh, we agree with Eleanor, we do need more data inclusion, we need to broaden the data sets and let the data reveal the truth. Because in tech, you want to just like get to a solution, and the solution is that, okay, the data is not enough, let's increase the data, then the system works. Would you agree with them? Is that something that you've heard, that tech people rushing to jump to an answer which is data oriented?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all know now that more data isn't the solution. It's about quality data. But this rush, the idea of big data, was relatively recent anyway, and I think it's just stuck with us, hasn't it? I really recommend this book, Queer Data, by Kevin Guillen, because it does show that the question of increasing the representation of queer communities isn't just about increasing more data about them, because that can be dangerous. One of my favorite examples of this was a friend of mine who worked for the World Food Programme and the UN agency, and she started collecting data about queer people in relation to food security, and this was great. But then when she went to input that data back into the UN systems, there was nowhere to input it because the system didn't have any, there was no scope to kind of store or aggregate this new information. So she just had to discard it. And I think this is a kind of classic example of just like collecting it because you think it's a good idea without any knowledge about the repercussions. What if that data was accessed by a government that was clamping down on the existence of queer people? Was it safe? Did these people have a kind of knowledge of how their data was being used? Was she using the right categorizations in the first place? So there's a lot of information that needs to be gathered in order to go about collecting this kind of data in the first place.
We got our community members to send a few questions in and around your work. I was wondering if you'd thought about AI in the realm of dating and sex robots, and what are the ethical debates, if at all, that's something that interests you.
I don't look a lot at sex robots, but we have an emerging team at CFI that look at social AI, which is about AI in relation to dating and sex. I am really interested in dating apps and the way AI is used to classify people on that, not least because I was on it for a very long time. And that's why I'm peer reviewing Kevin's new book called Rainbow Data, I think. I'm interested in how now dating tools and AI used in dating tools shape our sexual preferences. One of the statistics that Kevin uses is that one in three queer people around the world, queer couples, met on a dating app. So they are hugely influential, not just in shaping our lives, but also shaping how we identify ourselves. I'm certainly, as a young person, we know that lots of young people explore their sexuality through the kinds of categorizations that they see online. And I don't think it's worth discussing whether it's a good thing or not, but it's really nice and also quite interesting to see how technology is actually shaping the way that we engage in sex, and also the way that we think about ourselves and our identities. And I don't think this is new. You know, I think that technologies across time have shaped the way we identify sexually. But it'd be interesting now to see how those histories are kind of working with them, their way through to AI.
And the level of engagement of AI is deepening. I read about papers and articles about how people are finding romance partners, which are essentially bots, therapists, relationship therapists and otherwise, which are essentially large language model trained in a certain way. It does make it all pervasive. There are many women who are really upset, and men who were quite upset when a particular company turned off, a flirtatious tone by an algorithm because they felt that they'd actually lost a romantic partner. So yeah, this debate will continue to get more interesting. And the role of ethicists, I think, will be critical in helping us think through some of these debates. Would you agree?
Yeah, I agree. But I also think that, you know, social workers and people who specialize in loneliness, with or without AI, or in relationships more broadly, or, you know, they're the people that we need to turn to say, why are people looking for this in technology anyway? And how can we give it to them in a way that's safe, in a way that isn't sexist? It's a lot about the social fabric, of restoring the social fabric. And AI can be a bit of a misnomer in that. Sometimes we say, okay, how can an AI ethicist help us make this robot less sexual, or how can or make this, you know, sex robot do this, that, and the other? Whereas I don't know whether all ethicists are actually the right people to go to for this. What constitutes AI ethics expertise, basically, in robotics? And it's too easy to go for someone who claims to be an AI ethics specialist, when actually you can go to someone, people who've been doing this kind of work, not in the AI space, for a really long time.
We're coming towards the close of this discussion. We always ask a couple of questions about rethinking. So are there things or subjects that are relevant to your research that you've changed your mind about? If yes, what has like that change looked like? And do you feel that you now have a view which is very different from what it was before?
Oof, that's a great question. There's loads of things I've changed my mind about. I think, you know, one of the things that comes perhaps with age or just experience in academia is that the anger that we have towards people and opinions is tempered over time. We still have this amount of kind of like righteous justice energy that people in my field have that's important. For example, one of the AI engineers that I interviewed when I was working for a big tech organization said that the pendulum of diversity had swung too far in the wrong direction. He was a middle-aged guy in his 50s. And I think, you know, it's too easy to say, well, these people will die out, when actually, I think that what we've seen is that the gap between generations is overstated. There will always be people, young people, that have these feelings. And it's more about making people understand where they sit in the fabric of a changing organization. Because really, you know, middle-aged white men are really not at risk of their jobs being taken proportionally to other people in the organization. And the diversity narrative can be very loud and often misrepresent what's actually going on, which is very little. So I want people to feel like they know how they can be part of this change, why they'd want to be part of it, how they can support each other, and how that can improve their own lives. There's many ways that, you know, you might feel that even though everyone else is the same demographic on paper to you, your experience is actually quite different. And a diversity of experiences may allow you to be more yourself. Like with dating apps now, I don't think, you know, the queer category thing really accounts for the differences there are between heterosexual engagement either. There's lots of different ways of practicing heterosexuality. And as we move more into thinking about diversity, that will also help us understand masculinities, heterosexuality, in ways that allow people to be more themselves, even if they think that they're not represented by, you know, what diversity, in inverted commas, as a movement is trying to do. So that's one of the things that I'm really keen on exploring as well. And it involves being incredibly patient and kind to people, which I find, you know, can be really hard, really hard. But yeah, one of the things I'm really invested in, for sure.
It's a relevant debate. Recently, Google Gemini got all sorts of feedback about the way they interpreted diversity. I was wondering if you had any opinion on that.
Yeah, I actually gave a talk at DeepMind. God, you're not allowed to say this. I signed an NDA, but never mind. There was a really nice engineer who I was speaking to who had been working on Gemini. And he was really upset by the feedback, partly because he just really wasn't expecting it. He'd had no diversity training. He didn't really predict any of the pushback from either sides of the political spectrum, because, you know, there was dissent from the left and from the right, really, for different reasons. So I think, and my grand prediction for the next couple of years, is that computer scientists themselves will be pushing companies to give them some ethics training, because they find themselves on Twitter having to justify an answer to people who are attacking the stuff that they're building, and they're not sure how to respond. And it's not good enough now just to know how to program things. You have to understand what the public response is going to be, because otherwise these guys are up at night panicking about something that they created that they thought was nice and actually is getting a lot of, you know, giving them a lot of trauma. So I thought that was almost very encouraging to see. And I'm hoping that rather than, you know, we always thought, oh, we'll have to incentivize companies to give engineers ethics training. But I think it will soon become the other way around.
Absolutely. Let's see how time unfolds. I believe that you're an academic and entrepreneurial person on a mission. If you're wildly successful in the next decade, what does the world look like? What's the world that you'd like to see?
I would like to see more more faith in small acts, these incremental processes of change, which have been called political Tartar control. So the daily act of brushing your teeth. I think that there is a lot of hype about big change. And as we've seen from the recent anti-abortion laws, you can move backwards really quickly by moving forwards in a way that doesn't get everybody on board. So a really patient sense of change, tech unions on the rise with loads of members who understand what can be gained from being in a union. I'm looking forward to seeing more barristers and lawyers start defending tech unions, these solidarity movements on the rise. I'd like to see more people understand what activism is about. There was lots of, you know, especially in London, you know, lots of protests in the last few years, and people were either really on board or really not on board. And there's a lot of people who were understanding why people were protesting, but also really annoyed that the M25 was being blocked or something. And I think, you know, the realities of protesting are difficult and can really put people off. So I'd like to see more people engage in solidarity movements, but also those movements to become more inclusive and do better at voicing why it's important to be involved, whether they're AI related or not.
Fantastic. Is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't, or any concluding thoughts before we part ways?
No, thank you very much. Great, really great questions. I love being here. So yeah, thanks for having me.
I recommend everyone check out your podcast and read your book. Whether they agree with you or not, I think they should be part of this discussion. Eleanor, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.